and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature interviews with some of the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Degler. I am the head of media at TNW.
And I'm Linnea Ogden, senior editor at TNW.
Hello, Linnea. Great to see you. It's a glorious day. It started as a glorious day in Amsterdam. It's not like that anymore, but it's great to see you. How's it been?
It's been good, thank you. My voice is almost back to normal, as you can hear.
It's taken a while.
Yeah, it did. It took a disconcertingly long amount of time, but all good now. How are you?
Well, now it's my turn to be a little bit scratchy in terms of the voice. I feel like I'm still not recovered far from that. But I'm going to on vacation tomorrow, so I hope by the time I'm back, I will sound much better.
I am sure. I think that the climate where you're going is going to assist you in feeling right as rain in no time.
Yeah, the warmth of South Europe should do great things to my voice and probably to my mood.
Absolutely. I have no doubt.
Right. So let's get going with today's episode. We are going to discuss things like protein powder and carbon capture. That's in one breath. Then Europe's potential answer to Starlink, Disney's R&D department, how many browser tabs you can keep open, and much more. You will also hear an interview with Peter Sarlin, the CEO and founder at Silo AI. But first, let's talk about the story that we covered this week. Linnea, what did you decide to pick this time?
Yes, so you said protein powder and carbon capture. And obviously, this is not the protein powder that you put in your shake to increase muscle mass, but something quite a little bit more high-tech than that. And I want to talk about this because it's a startup that I've been following for a while now that I think has some really cool tech. And it's a cell-free biomanufacturing, and we can talk about what that means a little bit later, but a company from the UK called Fabric Nano. And just briefly to explain for now what they do, they're focused on making proteins or enzymes live longer outside of cells so that they can be used to make bio-based and biodegradable alternatives to things like plastic and other chemicals. But it turns out it can also be used for other environmental sustainability purposes, and that is carbon capture, and specifically carbon capture in the form of what is called enhanced rock weathering, or ERW for short. You might have heard about it in sort of the new carbon capture terminology that's becoming, I would say, increasingly popular.
Yeah.
As we start to shift away from carbon offset credits into carbon drawdown credits. The company Fabric Nano just this week announced that they have partnered with French utility giant Veolia to put the startup's technology to use to speed up carbon drawdown from the air.
Okay, that's great. I don't know that much about Veolia, but I guess it's a big one, right?
Yes.
Great. Yes, and so, okay, and then how exactly are they going to do that? Rock weathering, you said, right?
Yes. So enhanced rock weathering is a climate change mitigation technique. And regular weathering is a natural geological process where rocks and minerals break down or dissolve under the influence of water, atmospheric gases, and organic acids that are produced by soil microbes and plant roots. Now, this process normally takes place over very long geological timescales.
Yeah.
But in enhanced rock weathering, specific types of rocks, typically silicate minerals like basalt or certain types of volcanic ash, are selected because of their chemical properties like calcium content, etc. And these rock particles are then spread over agricultural land. And they then come into contact with rainwater, which has absorbed CO2 from the atmosphere. They form a weak carbonic acid, which then reacts with the silicate rocks and dissolves them.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
They then become part of the soil and the sedimentation cycle, meaning they're washed into the ocean where they contribute to the alkalinity of seawater, and eventually they end up as minerals in marine sediments. Now, this effectively locks away carbon in a stable form for thousands to millions of years, right? Great. Just like the carbon that we are that we have been taking out.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, it ends up buried in the ocean.
Basically, yes.
Great.
It's part of the sediment. But the problem is that, of course, this is a very slow process. And creating this kind of ultra-fine silicate dust that they use to spread over the soil requires specialist machinery that is very expensive, and it's also very difficult to scale.
Right. Now, I can imagine that. So it's a very, very long process that you just mentioned. Which part of it then Fabric Nano works with?
So Fabric Nano has come up with what they are calling accelerated rock weathering in order to speed up the process. And it's sort of a combination of biology and geology that would overcome the need for specialist equipment by making it possible to use normal rocks instead of specially pulverized ones from quarries and mines all around the world. And then you can use this rock directly locally where it's being produced. And they also add a specific enzyme mix to these rocks. It's sort of, this is where the protein powder comes right?
I was waiting for that.
Right, where's the protein powder? So it's sort of like a protein powder containing what is called carbonic anhydrase enzymes. And they increase the volume of carbon that the rocks can absorb. And they also speed up the conversion of CO2 and water into carbonic acid, which enhances the rate at which these rocks can weather. This is where the term weathering comes in, right? And then sequester the carbon. And the tech is currently in a trial stage at Oxford Agricultural Trials in the UK, which acts as an open-air laboratory for agricultural research.
Oh, this is really interesting.
And this is also the first time I heard about this project, and I find it's really interesting.
Right. So you mentioned that Fabric Nano is working with a cool tech. Okay, it does, but what exactly is it that these company itself has developed?
So normally, when you take a protein or enzyme out of a cell and try to get it to do stuff, meaning you feed it something and it makes something else, just as the proteins and the cells in your body take nutrients and they make skin, or yeast takes sugar and makes alcohol, for example. But when you take these proteins out of the cell, they don't usually survive very long. So that's why there's cell-based biomanufacturing where you use the cell as like a factory, but there are lots of issues with this as well, because you need to have the right environment for the cells to stay viable, etc. But Fabric Nano has developed what it calls an immobilization engineering platform. I know. It's a little bit overwhelming when you first dive into this. But we will leave links in the show notes that explain a little bit more about what cell-free biomanufacturing is.
It's really cool.
But so they use highly specialized data sets and machine learning to figure out what surface to bind the proteins to, meaning the proteins that they have extracted from the cells. If you bind them to a specific material, a specific surface, and it's different for each protein, then they last longer.
Okay.
So they don't unravel like the protein structure does when it's taken out of the cell after a little while. And this means that they can be put to work as an enzyme executing a very specific chemical reaction over and over again. So instead of the protein lasting for merely a few hours, it can last up to 6 months.
Okay.
And this is really an industrial game changer. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to this accelerated rock weathering, we're talking about bringing the process down from decades to a few years.
Wow.
Yeah. And this year alone, Veolia apparently plans to spread 30,000 tons of basalt rock powder across farmland. And for every ton of carbon removed, it's going to sell one carbon credit. We won't get into too much around carbon credits right now because that's a whole different can of worms. But companies and countries can then buy these credits as a way to offset their emissions.
I mean, but these are better carbon credits because these are carbon removal credits.
These are hopefully better carbon credits. It depends a little bit, of course, as with everything, the monitoring and reporting to what extent, to how much CO2 we're actually drawing down from the atmosphere. And no carbon credit is a good carbon credit if you're just using it as an excuse to keep on polluting, right? So I would say it depends, but yes, I am a big believer in the carbon removal markets as opposed to the purely carbon offset markets. And yeah, I think it's a really interesting company that has some very groundbreaking tech. And they're obviously working with larger chemical mm-hmm. companies and industry in order to find alternatives to plastics and chemicals and things like detergent, okay. these types of products, right? They currently employ 30 people, many of whom work in the company's lab facilities in Houston, in London. Right. And they have secured almost $25 million in funding to date, including from actor Emma Watson, known to most as Hermione from the Harry Potter films, and also Twitter co-founder Biz Stone. And this is the first sort of foray into carbon capture. And yeah, I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, it is quite exciting.
I want to share this story.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. And I think next week or the week after, we will feature an interview with someone who knows a lot about carbon removal. So if you're interested in this topic, do subscribe if you haven't yet to the show, and you will see it in your feeds very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Highly recommend that interview.
You got to add some intrigue, you know. Now, okay, let's move on to the story that we did not cover, but that was still, in my opinion, worth highlighting. So the story that I want to talk this week is, it's not exactly hard news, okay? So it's more of an update on how things are going with Europe's answer to Starlink.
Well, we always want updates on that. So.
Yes. I mean, the short answer to this question is not that great.
Oh, no.
But it's okay. I'm not saying that a European satellite internet constellation will never happen. It will, but it seems likely that it will take much longer than planned, which is something normal with the European project, I guess. So in case you don't remember, or in case you missed it entirely like I did at the time, last year, a consortium of European satellite companies, and there's a lot of them, announced a plan to build and launch a few hundred satellites to provide internet connectivity, in the same way that Starlink does, for example. Many companies are involved from all over Europe, but the leaders of the group are Airbus Defence and Space and Thales Alenia Space. The project itself is called IRIS², I think that's how it's read, which stands for Infrastructure for Resilience, Interconnectivity and Security by Satellite. And the idea last year was that the project would be done by 2027 and we will at least see the first satellites ready and maybe even launched.
Now we are I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for the new timeline here.
I don't actually think that there is a timeline right now, but...
it's indefinite.
Yeah, so, yes, it is. At this point, it is. But at this point, it is because the actual contract has not been awarded yet. So this is where we're getting to more recent events. So in March, we learned that the commission delayed the awarding of a contract to the consortium, which was actually, I think, the only bid for this project was from this very big consortium. And I don't think there are any other companies that could bid on that anyway.
No, I was going to say that those are the players in European space for this kind of technology. So.
But at the same time, there seems to be a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes. And the commissioner for internal market, Thierry Breton, said last month that, I quote, there is an independent committee which is working on the evaluation process. The work is being carried out extremely seriously, end of quote. Around the same time, the German newspaper Handelsblatt published a story that outlines the likely reasons for the delay. One of those reasons, again, shockingly, turns out to be that the cost estimate for the project has doubled already from 6 billion euros to 12 billion euros.
Oh, wow.
And in addition to that, Germany has sort of signaled that it's not particularly happy with the fact that most of the main contractors for the project are based in France. And Germany's opinion kind of counts in this case because it's likely to be one of the main financial backers of the project. And there seems to be a little bit of a tension in that quarter.
I see.
So if you want to have a deeper dive into all this, I will leave a link to a good story on the topic on Ars Technica. That's where I learned it from. But the long and short of it is that we're not likely to see the European Starlink happening anytime soon, but eventually it will most likely materialize.
Mm. Well, technically, Airbus Defence and Space is based in Germany. But I guess since it's a...
Yeah, since it's still Airbus.
It's still Airbus.
Yes,
true.
So apparently there is some unhappiness.
Yes. But we hope to see some developments soon.
No, yeah, I would be very happy if I were able to get satellite internet and at the same time not get it from Elon Musk.
Mm.
I think it's an unbeatable proposition.
Yeah. Yes, I will refrain from commenting because then people just say that I'm Musk bashing.
Okay, in this case, let's move to the learnings of the week. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that it's a bit of just a fun fact this week, really. And I'm sure most people probably know this, and I'm kind of late to the party. But I learned that Disney has a research and development department called Disney Imagineering.
Imagineering.
Yes, and I just found that such a nice name.
Sounds amazing.
And the department is responsible for the creation, design, and construction of Disney's theme parks. And there's some really cool stuff in tech coming out.
I can't imagine.
There.
Have you ever been to one?
No,
I
haven't. But and you know what? I never thought that I wanted to. But now that I've seen this and the things that they're creating, I'm like, no, that would actually be really cool to experience. So Imagineering has been granted over 300 patents, apparently, in areas like advanced audio systems, fiber optics, interactive technology, live entertainment, ride systems, virtual queuing systems, and special effects. One thing that I found really cool were the audio and animatronics.
What is that supposed to mean?
Essentially robotics. For mm-hmm. attractions like Pirates of the Caribbean, there's Remy from Ratatouille, and of course, WALL-E. And it just seems like the most fun job to be an inventor at Disney, you know, with Disney funding, nonetheless, you know, making BB-8 roll around.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah, and just delighting people. And so I just thought that was such a lovely way to spend your time. Anyway, why I learned this was because the internet's favorite YouTube reviewer, Marcus Brownlee, was invited to try out their latest secret project, which is not so secret anymore now, I guess.
Yeah, if you invite a YouTuber to try it out.
But it's a 360-degree sort of treadmill floor.
Okay.
Yeah. And no matter which way you walk, it will keep bringing you back towards the center. It's made up of all these small little, I don't even know what to call them. No, it's not balls. It's like little plates.
Or bearings
and
plates.
Yeah. Okay. And then they roll around and then they bring you back to center. And I think for the future, this could have some really cool consumer implications when it comes to VR entertainment and gaming as such. But it will take a little bit to get used to. But we will leave a link in the show notes as well to the video. And when you see the inventor behind this, when he's using it and how natural it looks and how seamlessly he moves, I think, you know, if you can get to there and then you couple that with some AR, VR and like,
Yeah, it sounds great because it is indeed like an issue with any VR system, really.
Absolutely.
That one way or the other, you are limited in terms of space and how you can walk and run and jump.
Exactly. Your body does not do the same thing that your visual field is telling you that you're doing. And so there's this sense of a little bit of motion sickness, etc. Yeah. And so
then you end up busy and disappointed. That's what happened to me.
And this is also something that if you see it, it's small enough that it can fit into your living room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good.
That's what I learned this week.
Amazing.
What did you learn this weekend?
Okay, before we talk about my learning, a quick question. Linnea, how many tabs do you have open in your browser on a normal day?
It depends a little bit on where I am with workload, but no more than 20.
No more than 20 is
max. But I do now, every time I finish a project or I finish something, like a part of the day, mm-hmm. I close everything down and then I open the things that I need for the next thing.
And then at the end of the day, you also close your, like try to at least close all the
tabs? I do, yes. Mm-hmm. And I make sure that I haven't missed something that's still open, etc. But, you know, and not naming any names, but I know people that that sometimes I accidentally glance at their screens and I go, how are... How are you?
Yes, some people's browsers are just anxiety inducing. Yes. I know.
So that. How come you're asking me this?
Okay, so it turns out that it is actually possible to have over 7,000 browser tabs open on Firefox in this case, and there is at least one person in the world for whom this is actually a totally normal practice.
I have so many questions.
So, okay, let's go through the story and then we can discuss our browsing habits and the browsing habits of the person in question. So the first of all, I learned this from a story that was run on a PC Mag, and the journalist talked to the Firefox power user who wished to be known only as Hazel. And this person, she has been keeping nearly 7,500 tabs open in her browser for over 2 years. And this actually came into light because at some point she lost all the tabs and posted online asking for potential ways to restore them, which she did eventually. There are backups if you don't forget to do them, so it's fine. And in an interview with PC Mag, Hazel said, and I quote, "I like to scroll back and see clusters of tabs from months ago. It's like a trip down memory lane on whatever I was doing or learning about or thinking about." And of course, the main secret here is that Firefox, generally, when you run the browser, when you launch it first, it doesn't load all the tabs when it restores them. So you just see all the tab headings, but they aren't actually loaded until you click them. So this is this is why it can be done without totally losing performance of your system. So I'm not surprised, because I'm also a Firefox user, so I kind of know this. But at the same time, just having 7,500 tabs open in my browser, that's not exactly the way I would do this. Let's put it this way.
No, I just find it so incredibly anxiety-inducing just to imagine. But I mean, yes, I understand why someone would be attached to this.
Absolutely.
I do. I just, when do you have time to look back?
Yeah, that's another question.
At that many clusters.
Yeah. But I do like the idea of treating most of your browser tabs as your to-do list, sort of. So basically, at the end of the day, everything has to be sort of parked somewhere.
Yes. And everything has to have been dealt with. Like the reason why that tab was open by the end of the day has to have been dealt with. Because I try to write down things that I need to get through and then tick them off. But I don't always. That doesn't always happen, but usually there will be a search history or something that will.
Yeah, it's like inbox, like inbox zero, but for tabs.
Yes.
And actually, I try to do inbox zero like almost everywhere. It's actually possible. Like on my WhatsApp, for example, I just archive everything when I'm done talking to someone or like about something, like in all messengers, in email. It makes a lot of sense. But I do have like 12 tabs that are just pinned. They're always open.
Oh, okay.
So basically, those are like apps, really, more than tabs. Yeah. And then the rest is just something that I normally try to also close by the end of the day.
I think as long as you have a system that like works for you, so it's not like this random, overtaking, overwhelming, just onslaught of online information or content, like this person Hazel. Okay, she has 7,000 something tabs open, but if she has a system for going over
sure
them
that said,
and looking
you,
at
you
them
by that time, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, or for example, you have so and so many tabs that are pinned and that works for you. I think as long as you don't feel overwhelmed or stressed out about the fact that like I would. But I don't see any problems with that.
So if you're listening to this and you would like to share your browsing habits, or maybe you want to challenge the record of Hazel and you have more tabs open, please do send screenshots and write us about it on podcast@thenextweb.com. We are always happy to hear from you.
Yeah, so if you have a specific habit that really works well, and you know, because I think we can all use
some productivity tips.
Yeah, productivity, but also better relationship with the technology in our lives. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let us move to today's interview. And this one is with Peter Sarlin. He is the CEO and founder at Silo AI. And we've covered this company. It's a Finnish AI company. We wrote about them several times in the past. So I was really excited, actually, to talk to Peter in person, which I did at TechChill in Riga a few weeks ago. So Peter has some very strong opinions on the European AI ecosystem and its future, which was great. And we discussed that in detail together with the work that Silo AI is doing on LLMs and so-called low-resource languages and everything around it. So here is the interview in full. Enjoy. Peter, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So as we usually do, can I ask you first to talk a little bit about yourself before we talk about the company? So what is it that you had been doing before you co-founded Silo, and what your passions had been? How did you grow up? What did you study and so on?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I guess my passion has always been related to machine learning and AI. Uh-huh. You know, we set up Silo at the end of 2017. As a private AI lab, together with a few co-founders, coming with both sort of an academic background, as well as then business and industry background. But before that, I basically did a PhD in machine learning, and then I was in professorship, basically led a research group focusing on applied machine learning, but always sort of spent time at the intersection of academia and industry, and wanted to really sort of see a real world impact of machine learning technologies. And that was before this AI wave, and that was before the previous AI wave in 2016, 2017. And of course, you know, different technologies and technologies have evolved a little bit, but I think, you know, ultimately, the technology behind AI, machine learning, is sort of the same and relies on the same principles. And you know, that's eventually then jumping ship from academia was, I would say, a fairly obvious decision. I'm still in a part-time professorship at Aalto University in Helsinki, but basically jumping ship from a full-time tenured professorship was an easy decision in the sense that ultimately we had an aligned view with the co-founders that we wanted to sort of ensure that Europe has an AI flagship. And I believe that we can have a larger impact if we do that as a commercial activity. And that's sort of the background. Most of my career has been, I'm originally from Finland, but most of my career has been elsewhere. So, you know, we lived in and spent time in Germany, in London, in Stockholm, Sweden. I'm myself a native Swedish speaker, but of course, Finland is a bilingual country, and have sort of roots in many places. So I've, in the same way as Silo has seen the company as sort of a global company, I've also seen myself as a global citizen. And of course, we have sort of roots in Europe, we have roots in the Nordics, we have roots in Finland, but we're still sort of a global company.
And when you say that Silo was founded as a private AI lab, what does it actually mean in practice?
That's a very good question. It means that you can look at it from many different perspectives. I mean, our mission was to ensure that Europe has an AI flagship company in the 2030s. We had a long-term perspective. And that with the intent to ensure that European companies stay competitive, and with the intent to ensure that we're retaining leading AI talent in the region. And we believed that's important in 2017, and we still believe that's important, right? I think from a sort of talent perspective, we've always wanted to ensure that we can attract the best and hence sort of create an environment where world-class AI scientists sort of feel that they belong home and actually can create an impact. And so people joining us oftentimes have a PhD. Majority of our employees, 350 people, have a PhD in AI-related fields and have sort of spent quite a long career in academia, but then eventually have decided that they actually want to have a real-world impact and sort of move from pure-play research to actually sort of work on industrial engagements and research and R&D in that context. And so that's one angle. And then, you know, the long answer has another angle as well. And that's really, how do you create value with AI? And as a private AI lab, we are positioned to help our clients succeed in building AI at the core of their products. And that's the way we look at value creation. Sort of AI and value through AI is distributed via digital products and digital services. AI in itself and on its own is not a product. And hence, sort of, we work with industry-leading companies, companies like Rolls-Royce, Unilever, Philips, and so forth, sizable companies that are investing heavily at the core of their business, their product, services, processes, in building a software product or digital platform, and then AI at the core of that. And for that, sort of, we believed and we still believe that Europe needs a private AI lab, an AI flagship that can help companies be competitive.
Makes a lot of sense. But then on the other side of things, you are known for your open source models that you release regularly. So how do you balance the two directions, and sort of what vision do you assign to this other part?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Silo basically offers as a trusted AI partner, and now having been in the space for 6 years, and just to basically still connect our background and way of looking at the market, is that we've more than doubled in size, both revenue and headcount, through profitable growth 4 years in a row. And that's sort of taken us to where we are now in having a sort of in place a private AI lab with almost 350 people and then infrastructure and tooling to basically accelerate value creation and creating sort of AI-driven products and then models. So what we offer is a combination of models, infrastructure and tooling, and pre-built components, and then services. And yes, indeed, I mean, models play a key role. We could talk a lot about the open source large language model initiatives that we have put in place. But I think the ultimate and very brief sort of background is that we believe it's crucial for Europe and European sovereignty, for every single country, that there exists open source models as a digital infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And does it mean that you expect more and more people and companies to actually pick up on that and use those open source models for their own goals?
Yes. So, I mean, there's a sovereignty perspective that sort of relates to models that have reasoning capability that actually descends from the specific regions, or data from these regions and texts from these regions. And that's what we are accounting for, which is not the case with sort of English-focused models. Basically, all other open source models, or close to all other sort of performant open source models out there, where, they might speak the language, but it's coming through a translation capability. So there's a sovereignty question there, where it's important that these models are representing the sort of value base, the culture, the language of individual regions. But even more importantly, I would say, from the perspective of companies in the specific region, wherever that is that there exists performant open source models. And now, sort of to your question, yes, I mean, on top of open source based models, which I see just as a starting point, you then specialize and you sort of customize the model to the specific use case or the specific need you have. And with that, you can build sort of performant, efficient, effective models that are trustworthy and are sort of, not only creating value, but also ensuring that you own and control the model. And as a company, then the value that is created stays with that company, with the region.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This makes a lot of sense. And so what we have covered over the past few months in regards to Silo was the low resource, the models for low resource languages. And if we could cover that a little bit. So what is a low resource language, for first of all?
I think the unfortunate reality today is that everything except for English. So, you can come up with many definitions, but the reality is that, by far, the majority of text, data, produced today and available and accessible through means that allows training these large language models, which is the internet, is in English. And that means that English dominates. And, mm-hmm. and basically, I think there is a need to ensure that every single other language is accounted for in a good way, especially in Europe. I don't think we have other languages that are sort of, without explicitly addressing them, going to be represented in these large language models. And that's the perspective we took. So we started off last and during the autumn last year, training with the intent to ensure that we have best-in-class models for all EU languages without compromising performance in English. And that's what we proved early this year when we released a model called Poro, so reindeer in Finnish, which includes then, yes, Finnish, but also English and programming languages.
Right.
And what we actually prove with this is that the approach we're taking and then expanding to other languages works. So it produces performant models where we sort of rely on the so-called cross-lingual signal. So, you know, the signal of the low-resource language is strengthened by training in specific ways. And so it's the world's best model in Finnish. But it's still on par with, say, Llama, Falcon, the Mosaic model, MTB, and such in English. And it's actually more performant in programming languages. So it's a performant model. And now, 2 weeks back, we released a model called Viking, or a model family. So a set of different models, different sized models, which expands from English programming languages and Finnish to also include Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, and Icelandic. So you have the Nordic languages represented. And at the moment, we're training a model that includes all official EU languages.
Okay. So is Poro now part of Viking?
Viking is the basically the so-called next model generation. It goes with a separate name, but it relies on the same sort of training approach. Yes.
And I remember that you stated before that actually the Poro, for example, it does outperform larger models in Finnish. But like, but how can it be? Like, my understanding has always been that the bigger the model is, the better the performance is. How is it not like that?
Well, yeah, it's actually not at all like that,
necessarily.
Of course, you know, with a larger model, you can build a more performant model. But I mean, I think all of this is still research today. I mean, we don't know what works, or there are no general rules out there what works and what doesn't. So everything requires sort of a lot of experience and experimentation. And I would say in many cases, it's more sort of an art than a science in how you sort of parameterize these or how you optimize these specific neural networks. But yeah, I mean, we've benchmarked Poro to models that are monolingual Finnish models and then also models that have continual pre-training. So where you have a model that includes many languages and then you've continued pre-training of that model to with Finnish data. And there, for instance, the Bloom model includes more than 170 billion parameters, whereas Poro is approximately 30 billion parameters. I mean, it's not always true. And I think this is a reality, especially when you start to add languages and add other capabilities. You actually need to know what you're doing. It's not enough to just basically collect a bunch of data and you know, press a button to start training a model if you have access to a lot of compute. So I think the most difficult part is actually to sort of know how to do it in an optimal fashion, because eventually you need to cram quite a lot of information and knowledge into these models that are now getting sort of smaller and smaller actually in size in many cases. And I would say that smaller is better because ultimately, I mean, that's the way we look at value creation. LLMs, large language models, become just an embedded and integrated part of software products to support the end user in specific tasks as, you know, enterprise software, CRMs, ERPs, healthcare, finance, media software, and so forth, sort of embed these LLM-based features in the same way as GitHub Copilot is doing and Microsoft Copilot is doing and so forth. But if they're not horizontal use cases, they don't need to be able to talk about everything, right? No, they need absolutely. To be able to be trustworthy on a specific topic. And there usually you can do really well with mm-hmm. a fairly small model that is then specialized for a specific topic.
Okay. And now you're also training Poro 2, right? I think you mentioned it before.
Yes, exactly. But Poro 2 is basically what we call Viking, mm-hmm, or what was mm-hmm. released as Viking.
Right.
And that's the model that expands from having three languages, or basically having Finnish, English, and programming languages, to mm-hmm. including the Nordic languages. And then, you know, at the moment, as said, we're also training the next model family, which covers all European or EU
languages. That's a really big undertaking. And speaking of training, how do you approach the question of licensing and the ethics when training the models?
So, I mean, that is a very good question, and we've cooperated with many initiatives that have been committed to the EU AI Act even before mm-hmm. it was sort of in place. So the data initiative that is behind the data that we've collected is through or together with an EU initiative called mm-hmm. HPLT. And high performance language technologies. And basically, together with that initiative, we've collected a data set covering 22 trillion tokens.
Across the EU languages?
Across 75 languages, mm-hmm. but with good coverage for EU languages. And all of those data sets are publicly released. And mm-hmm. the same with the models. We're releasing all of the data that we're using, so it's fully transparent. We're transparent when it comes to the model weights, of course, which mm-hmm, is what mm-hmm. you normally do. But we release or we publish also what data we use. We publish mm-hmm. basically what architecture we use. And we also basically release model checkpoints throughout training, so you can follow how the model basically develops in performance. So, yes, I mean, you know, as an example, with the... One of the data sets that has been questioned quite significantly is the Books 3 data set, mm-hmm. Which we dropped from training as an example. And such detail you will find in the model card that is public on Hugging Face.
Right, makes a lot of sense. And so, I mean, it's been a pretty hot topic, generative AI in general, large language models over the past couple of years. And there's a lot going on, right? And there are a lot of companies working on it. We have in the US, we have OpenAI, we have Facebook with Llama. Here in Europe, we have you, we have Mistral, we have Aleph Alpha. So what is the competition like? What's the landscape like? How do you look at it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think maybe I'll start by positioning Silo, mm-hmm. which I think then eventually makes the question quite trivial. I mean, Silo helps companies build industry-leading products mm-hmm. where AI sits at the core. And basically, our approach to large language models, and that's what we've believed throughout, is that ultimately sort of open source models will converge and ultimately it basically relies on what data they mm-hmm. Use when they're being trained, and you will have very performant open source models out there. What we have been trying to ensure is that there exist performance models that also sort of tackle low resource languages, mm-hmm. which isn't obvious to happen. But ultimately, the way we look at value creation is that it happens on top of open source models. So what we provide is a model as a service platform or model mm-hmm. serving platform that sort of includes automated continuous fine tuning mm-hmm. Based upon usage feedback. And that includes so-called RAG and vector databases to ensure trustworthiness of the models mm-hmm. for specific use cases. And of course, you know, all of the sort of security and other related topics that you need to think about when you go to production. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're seeing in the market at the moment, is sort of, you know, for some use cases, you'd want to use a performant closed source model. Especially many use cases that are not sitting at the core of your specific product or your business. And you know, there you might want to pick a model from some of these players like OpenAI or for instance, say Mistral or, mm-hmm. or Anthropic or such. But then on the other hand, if you are sort of looking for performant, efficient, small models that you control and own with low latency and so forth, then basically we provide an option to do that. And I think those are two very different things. So in that sense, I personally think that only a tiny share of the market and the use cases will sort of require a horizontal general purpose AI model that is performant, very large and performant for many things. A majority of the use cases will actually basically be very focused and require sort of a model that is reasoning capability is good, but basically the sort of specifics around a specific use case are tackled best in class.
And this is something that you are doing as a part of your business. So you're creating this narrower models for certain use cases.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what we provide, a subscription to a platform that does that. So serves the model, provides the sort of continuous optimization of the model, and provides tooling and infrastructure around it. And then, of course, yes, I mean, we have a sizable team of now almost 350 people, world-class scientists that are helping our then clients and the companies we work with to succeed in you know, maybe pushing a little bit the frontier by doing additional continual pre-training or adding additional capability and knowledge on the side and so forth. So I think that's a crucial element, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And do you keep track of how many clients, how many projects you've had so far?
Well, I mean, we work with, and it's worth noting that we've been in the space for more than 6 years and we've done sort of profitable growth for many years. And that has implied that we've always been very client and driven and sales driven in the sense. So, I mean, we have a lot of clients that we continue to work with. And then, of course, we are onboarding all the time new clients to the platform. And I think the reality at the moment is that with Silo Gen, which is basically the unit at Silo that is providing the platform and building the models, is onboarding both new clients as much as we can onboard at the moment, and then is of course also serving clients that Silo has been working with for the past many, many years.
Right. And so a question then, with all the breakthroughs and developments in how models are trained and with potential breakthroughs in quantum computing that we are expecting to see in the coming decade, does it mean that the actual training of models will become a bit of a commodity? So like everyone would be able to train their own model at the end of the day?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think quantum computing is not yet having an impact on how you train machine learning models. We could discuss a lot about that, but I think that's sort of ultimately how I would conclude it. Looking ahead, it will have an impact. But the specific question is, should everyone train their own large language model? And even though you would be able to, I don't think everyone should be training their own large language model in terms of foundation models. Because I look at the foundation model, I mean, basically foundation models are just sort of a lot of weights, a lot of parameters, a lot of numbers. Nothing else. I mean, it sounds as if it would be something very magical, but it's just a number, a set of numbers. The set is big, it includes billions of numbers, but nevertheless. And that's a starting point. So I do think there's going to be better and better. And I think, you know, we don't know where we're going to exactly be in 1-2 years. I mean, we will, you know, of course, innovate and push, but others will do so as well. And there will be a lot of good models for different use cases. But that's a starting point. And I think most companies should use the best open source models out there and ultimately then ensure that they optimize the models for their specific use case. And this is the reason why I think that it's so crucial that you own and control both your model and your data. Because ultimately, when you in, say, 1 year or 2 years, move from one model to another, you should be able to move together with the data mm-hmm. that you've been collecting on usage and also the model in order to ensure that you can then optimize again the next better foundation model. Mm-hmm. But it's important mm-hmm. to know that those are just starting points.
Right. And you also mentioned just now that you expect in the future that open source models would converge eventually. How would that work?
Well, I mean, I think I said it all more than a year back, beginning of last year, and I think we're already seeing that. Like mm-hmm. if you're seeing the recent open source releases of these general purpose AI models mm-hmm. that are trying to tackle sort of this GPT-4 type of tasks and evaluate it in terms of the evals that measure sort of the quality of GPT-4 or horizontal use cases. You can see that there are GPT-4 level mm-hmm. open source models being released already today.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is sort of, in a sense, proving the convergence of open mm-hmm. source with closed source. And of course, we are expecting GPT-5 to be released. Eventually, there will be more closed source models, but there will also be more open source models. And I think ultimately that open source has already picked up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I think it's a totally different use case you're solving when you are sort of solving a horizontal chatbot versus basically something that you integrate in, say, customer support software or in media software or in healthcare software mm-hmm. or in an ERP system.
Yeah, you don't want to integrate that.
Not necessarily, no.
Right. So to wrap this up, I really wanted to try and take a wider look at the ecosystem and hear your take on the general European AI ecosystem. So what is it like at this point in your opinion, and what do you think the future of it is?
That's a broad question, but a question very close to my heart and of course Silo's mission as well. But we believe it's very crucial that we are now sort of taking the correct actions to ensure competitiveness in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all obvious that it's happening. I've said many things on the topic previously, but maybe if I try to sort of summarize the sort of angle I have and bring something new to it. One thing is that overall to succeed in AI, I think you need three ingredients. That's data, compute, and talent. And I think, we are doing fairly well when it comes to talent
mm-hmm.
In that basically we have very highly ranked universities and academic talent in AI is known to be of very, very high quality mm-hmm. in Europe, in however you want to rank that. Compute, the commission and EuroHPC has been doing tremendous efforts in putting up supercomputers like Lumi, which we are using to train our models,
mm-hmm.
But also others now coming up. And then ultimately data. I think the environment is challenging, so we need to put in more effort to ensure that we can build, for instance, language models in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult compared mm-hmm. to North America, for instance. But I think ultimately, even though you have all these three components, as I said, value is created and distributed through digital products and services. And then the question is, how many of these software products or basically digital products and services are based in Europe?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one key element we should actually be focusing on in thinking of how AI innovation actually sort of creates value that stays in Europe. It's mm-hmm. not only about sort of doing research and building models, but it's really about ensuring that European companies succeed in distributing value at scale. That would be my, even though I say it as a private AI lab and we're the ones building the models and so forth, But for us to be able to create value in Europe and to European companies, we of course also work with companies across the world. Mm-hmm. But to succeed in Europe, we need software product companies.
Right. You've clearly been thinking about it quite a bit. Is this something that's, that you sort of keep iterating upon, like your vision of this?
Of course, you know, these are thoughts that have been developing during the past several years. At the same time, this is in a sense what we do. This is how we believe value is created, and this is what we're seeing in the market. We're operating in Europe, we're operating in North America. Mm-hmm. Even though sort of everyone is talking about regulation is not the sort of major challenge yet, but mm-hmm. of course also that might mm-hmm. end up being a sort of an additional burden. And hence I think it's just so important that we in Europe focus on, you know, the things we're good at, and then sort of making the best out of the things that we're good at. And we're actually doing fairly well when it comes to the key ingredients in creating AI.
Understood. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time, and good luck with everything you're doing with Silo.
Thanks a lot. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Once again, big thanks to Peter for finding the time to come on the show. At this time, this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about us and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us almost everywhere. Music and sound engineering for this podcast is done by Sound Pulse. Please feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am Andrei Degeler.
And I'm Linnea Algen.
Have a great week. I will not talk to you next Wednesday, but Linnea will. In the meantime, goodbye.
Bye-bye.